This is a special showcase episode of the Round Table Podcast. 20 minutes with T. Morris.
Hello, everyone. I'm Brian Humphrey.
And I'm Dave Robinson.
And you're listening to the Round Table Podcast and this week's 20 Minutes With.
20 Minutes With is the opportunity for Brian and I to sit down with our esteemed guest hosts and pick their brains a bit, go through their creative processes, learn how the creative muse is stimulated and inspired, and hopefully glean a few gems that we can share with our listening audience. And this evening, O'Brien, my co-host.
Oh, Lordy.
Yes, this is when we add to our roster of the true Renaissance men and women out there in the author and podosphere world. Our guest host, I'll get halfway through this and everybody will know who it is, but I'm going to roll it anyway.
Do it.
Began and continues to be, I think, in my mind, a journalist. He's a thespian and author and a burgeoning connoisseur of fine scotch and cigars. He is the co-author of Podcasting for Dummies and Advanced Podcasting for Dummies with Chuck Tomasi, Evo Terra, and Craig Stepp, and the co-founder of Podiobooks.com, for which we thank him and Evo Terra and Chris Miller. Onward, ding, yes, there it is. He's written The Complete Guide to Fantasy Writing, The Fantasy Writer's Companion, and he can do this. He's got the cojones, the chops to do this, because he is the author and podcaster of Moravi, The Chronicles of Rafe and Ascana, which was one of the first podcast novels ever to shout across the podosphere, and personally, one of the very first ones I ever listened to when I was getting into this whole scene. He wrote and podcast Bilbo Baddings in the Case of the Singing Sword, winning the 2008 Parsec for Best Audio Drama. The sequel, The Case of the Pitcher's Pendant, is in development, and I'm sure we'll hear about that at some later date. He writes with Pip Ballantyne for the ministry. He writes the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences novels with the lovely and talented Pip Ballantyne. Those include Phoenix Rising and The Janus Affair. He wrote recently and released on Kindle the Aladdin and His Wonderfully Infernal Advice, which I sadly confess still languishes on my Kindle unread. I'm so sorry.
Mine at least isn't languishing. I just got it today.
It's fresh.
It's fresh and ready.
And last but not least, and I'm sure this isn't even last, but you can tune in weekly and catch him and Pip on The Shared Desk. Ladies and gentlemen, it is with great pleasure and honor that we introduce...
Evo Terra, ladies and gentlemen, Evo Terra. Come on down.
Or T. Morris.
Hi, everybody.
T. Morris, welcome to the show, T. Thanks, man, for taking the time.
You're calling this show 20 minutes, right? 20
I know. Minutes. I know, right?
Like on that.
I need to like find the abbreviated version or begin talking like an auctioneer.
I'm just saying that I tend to talk.
Yeah. A lot. I think Justin McCumber described you as a fire and forget missile. That we just write a question, we can go off and make a sandwich.
Push the button. Prop your feet up.
Brew some beer.
Smoke if you got them. Yeah. By the time... Yeah, no problem.
Just take some really creative editing is all.
Yeah. There's one thing I will... I mean, your wonderful introduction was lovely. I did want to correct one little thing. The Case of the Pitcher's Pendant is not in production. In fact, I will tell you right now, it will probably be very, very doubtful if I ever podcast another novel again.
Holy crap.
Well, no. There's a method to the madness. Okay. It's what it boils down to is and we're going to get into the creative stuff in a second, but what it boils down to is the amount of time. I mean, it's a labor of love. I mean, I did Billy, I did Moravi Remastered. I did all that because I loved it. And the upside was that when you love something and you're doing it, you have a blast doing it. Of course. I mean, I had a ball doing both of those, but I realized that it was just cutting way too much into my writing time. So I had to make a choice. And the one thing you missed, unfortunately, is how I'm getting my podcast fiction fix. And I found out how I can have the best of both worlds. Pip and I are producing an anthology podcast called Tales from the Archives.
Ah, yes. You're right. I didn't miss that.
Yeah, this is the way we introduce people to the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. And what it is it's short stories set in that universe. Other people write them. We write a couple of them, but most other authors come in and they hand us the story already recorded. And then we go in and we add in the stuff
the
that
rapper.
I do. They give me the lamb and I sprinkle on the rosemary and the gravy and all that stuff.
And get and, to serve it up.
Yeah, exactly. In fact, the following day from the recording of this, a lovely young lady named PJ Schneider. She has never podcast anything ever. She has never recorded she did an entire blog post about what it was like to record something for podcast. And it was the first time she ever heard herself read, and it kind of freaked her out. Well, today she just heard, she got an advanced listen to what's going live tomorrow. And she was like, oh my God, I didn't know you were going to do that. And I mean, this is kind of common because people who podcast for us are like, okay, I'm going to record my story. There you go. But if they've never heard my podcast or Pip's podcast, they have no idea that we like to throw in, like we're the J.J. Abrams of podcast fiction. We
The underscoring, the sound effects, exactly. The full production.
I'm a sucker for that. That's the thespian in me coming out.
Well, yeah. Well, and the lover of audio fiction too. I mean, that's the full experience.
But really, I had to make it. And you know, if you were to get the first nugget about what it is that drives me, or what it is that I have to do as a writer, you have to pick and choose your battles. And as much as I love doing full length podcast fiction, I just can't see me dedicating that kind of time. And so if it came down to, do I want to write or do I want to podcast the fiction? I really want to be able to write. I want to be able to write first and foremost.
Do me a favor, if you would.
Sure.
Write an email to Justin McCumber and absolve him of turning Haywire over to audible.com for them to produce. He is writhing, anguishing because of his longstanding support of all the podcasters who've started out with their audio books. And he feels like he's betrayed us.
Well, it's funny you should say that, because I am a reader for Audible. While I probably will never podcast long form fiction, right now I'm in the middle of recording not one but two audiobooks for Audible.
Dude, I guess that ACX audition thing worked for you, yo.
Of course. I knew this is what was going to happen. I got not one but two offers for royalty share audiobooks. One of them is by a friend of mine, Keith R.A. DeCandido. And I know the guy that's
kind of cool.
Yeah, it's very cool.
You know the author, you can call him up, say, how do you pronounce this fucking name?
Exactly. That's what he told. And I've done that. So I got these two gigs. I'm in the middle of them. What happens? I get a new day job. So right now I'm juggling all that. Oh yeah. And there's the podcast going on. Oh yeah. And we're shooting the book trailer this weekend and next weekend. Oh yeah. And we're launching a book next month. So smoke if you got them, bro. Shit, I need a drink
from a fire hose much, dude? Holy crap.
Why not?
Yeah.
But in my fire hose, I got a 20-year-old scotch.
See, I thought we were going in a whole different direction with that, and I was sorry I brought it up. So thank you for steering us in the scotch way.
There you go.
So we're going to earn that explicit ranking on iTunes, goddammit.
Fuck yeah.
All right.
So what do you want to know?
Okay, let's see. Well, in the 5 minutes remaining.
I told you.
First of all, two quick things. PG Holyfield wrote and said, you finally got a hat that he likes. And he says you made him carry his books around at all the cons when he was starting out.
I did not.
That's what he said. I got it in writing here, bud.
That prick. No, he offered. And I was like, no, not really. He's like, no, really, really. I want to carry your books, Mr. Morris. Carry your books. I've been watching you.
Oh, put that man back in the closet, all right? That's beyond explicit.
PG and I go back.
Clearly. All right. That's all. That's all. Just want to put that out there. I delivered my message. Now it's my turn.
I'm going to kick him in the nuts.
Son of a bitch.
I'm surprised you don't have a few drop-ins queued up for this.
I really should.
I'm sorry, Ty.
All right.
So T. Morris, yes, author, podcaster, journalist.
Last time I checked.
Yes. Here's my question. This is actually a survey that I'm taking informally among genre fiction writers. Moravi, The Chronicles of Rafe and Ascana, Bilbo Baddings, Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences. You are wallowing. You are rolling like a warthog in heaven in fantasy, fiction, genre fiction, definitely drawing deeply from those tropes and structures of that genre. And I want to ask you why genre fiction? What is it about fantasy and steampunk that is so ideal for telling your particular tales that some other genre wouldn't do?
The people I blame Jules Verne and I blame Ian Fleming.
Okay.
So as a kid, my parents, they've said to me before, now that I'm a grown adult and I'm a parent myself, my parents have said to me, we didn't know what we were doing when we were raising you, son. So they let me, they let me do things that I probably wouldn't let my kid do right now. And one of the things, my dad was a big fan and still is a big fan of James Bond, particularly the Connery and Moore years. And he would take me to the James Bond films when they came out. So as a kid, I'm seeing, I think is where my breast fetish came from, but but I see not just the hot babes, but I also see these gadgets, these wonderful, wonderful gadgets. And then along with that, we had, you know, Sunday evenings on NBC, The Wonderful World of Disney. And every time I sat down in front of that TV, I wanted to be one of two things. I either wanted it to be one of the original, and I do stress that the original, Winnie the Poohs, or I wanted it to be 20,000 Leagues Under the Sea.
Ah, yes.
Because I was so fascinated. I mean, that was my ride when we went to Disney World. Even as a teenager, I had to get inside the effing Nautilus. I had to hear the voice of Captain Nemo talking me through where we were going. And so in the middle of all this, you know, and growing up with this complex and the breast fetish, I make friends online with this very talented photographer named J.R. Blackwell.
Ah, yes.
And I get to know her and her husband, Jared Axelrod, two of the most frighteningly creative people I think I know. And they're showing me, I'm seeing these pictures, these wild pictures that they're doing. And I go, what is this? And they go, oh, it's called steampunk. And I'm beginning to see, wait a minute, I can have my Jules Verne with a side of Ian Fleming. I can have my Victorian science and the posh and the lush and the stylistic look. And I can have gadgets too. Sweet shit on a cracker. I love this genre.
Sign me up.
So yeah, sign me up. And originally when we were starting off the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences, we were going to do it as a podcast for pay. That was the original idea for what was then called Books and Brawn, which eventually became the Ministry of Peculiar Occurrences series.
Right.
And but I mean, for me, genre fiction, I've always liked genre fiction because literary fiction, yeah, it's nice, but it can get a little pretentious. I mean, not to speak ill of the dead, but I always wanted to kick Michael Crichton in the nuts because he refused to say he was a science fiction author. When you're talking about faxing people back into the past, I hate to break it to you, Tex, but you're a science fiction author.
Oh, hell yeah.
I mean, King, Stephen King, his acceptance speech when he won the highest literary award in the country, and he basically gave a giant fuck you to the entire literary community. I was like, it's about damn time. And they were real brave behind his back, but nobody was going to say that to Stephen King's face because he's Stephen fucking King.
That's right. He can buy you tea 10 times over.
Exactly. So, I mean, So I actually have people said, so how's your little book doing?
Ooh.
I heard that about Moravi.
Oh,
and then there was, yeah. And then for steampunk, for the ministry, this is my first award-winning book. This is the book that basically was the only, Bragan writes, this is the only steampunk that made it to the finals in any of the genres in Goodreads 2011 Choice Awards. And we were right up there in the top 10 with Charlie Strauss and the aforementioned Stephen King and Chyna Miéville. There was Pip Ballantyne and T. Morris. So fuck you very much for the people who said to me, oh, you jumped on that bandwagon, did you?
Oh man.
Yeah.
Well, you know, haters are going to hate, dude.
Haters going to hate.
That's right.
And that, you know, they can hate while I'm wearing my goggles.
That's right.
We'll continue our conversation with T. Morris after this brief promotional break.
Hi, I'm Big Anklevich.
And I'm Rish Outfield.
And that's R080T.
We're your hosts for the Doonstief audio fiction magazine.
On the Doonstief, we read science fiction, fantasy, and horror stories.
What did he say?
He says that you're a loser. If you've never listened to the Doonstief, you don't know what you're missing.
Stupid, worthless robot. After the story, there's witty banter and discussion from the hosts. What did he say this time?
He says that you're a loser. The best part about the discussion is that it's at the end, so it's easy just to skip it.
Right, so come check out the Doonstief audio fiction magazine.
Find us at www.doonstief.com.
That's D-U-N-E-S-T-E-E-F. What did he say? That I'm a loser?
No, he said that if you check out the Doonstief, you'll be glad that you did.
Huh.
And he said that you're a loser.
Friggin' robot!
Now, let's get back to the conversation with T. Morris.
So are you telling me that this is nurture? This is the lens through which you see the world, that the stories you tell, they're not going to be horror, they're not going to be detective, they're not going to be westerns, they're not going to be romance. They've got give me steampunk and fantasy, or give me death?
No, because I do write horror, and I do write, I mean, I've written other genres, and really what it boils down to is I don't really care so much about the genre, I care more about the story.
Okay.
For me, it's the story that matters. So if I'm going to write a story and it's going to be a detective novel set, you know, it's going to be a hardboiled detective mystery, but it's going to be a, I'll give you the inspiration of Billabub Battings. It was a friend of mine in Seattle, artist out in Seattle. She sent me a gag reel of a whole bunch of just wacky sketches and things like that. And on there, on this cassette, yeah, I'm an old fart. On this cassette was Leonard Nimoy singing The Legend of Bilbo Baggins, which I'd never heard before. And I was stunned at the atrocity I was listening to, but at the same time, I was fascinated by it. And I still remember I was driving to a rehearsal, singing along with this goofy song this was the third time I was listening to it. I was singing along, and suddenly the name Billabub Battings popped into my head. And then I just said out loud, "And the case of the singing sword."
Because it scans so nicely.
And people are honking at me because I'm trying to drive with one hand, but I'm writing on a scratch piece of paper the opening line. And I said, okay, so this is going to be a detective novel. I get to have Mike Hammer, but Mike Hammer is Peter Dinklage. Before I knew who Peter Dinklage was.
Right.
I mean, originally I always pictured David Rappaport, but now I got the screaming panties for Dinklage. And to me, that's what really matters. I'd never written detective noir before. I'd never written detective fiction before.
But then you made the choice to set it in a fantasy setting.
Well, no, I set it in a historical setting.
Okay.
I just added a fantasy twist to it.
And that's the question that I'm asking. What is it that prompted you, that made this story so perfect for you, that without that fantasy twist, the story would be incomplete?
Because really, it's me being greedy.
You want
it all. You know, you don't want, you don't just want the burrito with steak. You want the burrito with steak, and you want to have the sour cream in there. And not only that, you are going to pay that extra fucking dollar for the guacamole.
Okay, metaphor man, let's bring it back down to the real world, shall we? All right.
I mean, but that's what I mean. That's what I mean. It's. I wanted to write. I mean, I've always been a fan of Mike Hammer. I've always been a fan of that hard-boiled detective, and and I, you know, maybe this is also because I no one has ever really asked me this, but so this will be the first time I've really talked about it. The Singing Sword itself was actually something that came out of one of the classic Warner Brothers cartoons of Yosemite Sam and Bugs Bunny.
Okay.
There was a Yosemite Sam Bugs Bunny episode that involved a singing sword, and it just stuck with me as a kid.
Okay.
And I mean, but there you have the King Arthur legend or you have the Arthurian legend, but then you got Bugs Bunny coming in being a wise ass. You know, when it came to Warner Brothers, they did that. They were like, you know what? We want to have our cake and eat it too.
The first so mashups.
The mashups. And really with mashups, it's either win or go home. If you commit, you commit all the way. And some mashups work really well. Some don't. And for this particular story, the mashup of a detective that was a dwarf from a fantasy realm, that was my way of saying, yeah, I want to tell Mike Hammer, but I want to tell Mike Hammer from you know, J.R.R. Tolkien's point of view.
Okay.
And that opened it up for a lot of nice interplay. Now we talk about, you know, let's talk about Aladdin and his infernal device.
Okay.
So right now steampunk is hot. So is fairy tales, and people are writing, you know, steampunk. They're trying to do steampunk fairy tales, and
like your wife,
like my wife, and I find, and you know, and I have no ifs, ands, or buts about it. They basically read the idea. They read the idea. They liked the idea. I wrote the story, and they said, well, it's not steampunk enough. So they rejected it.
Wow.
Now I got two choices. I got a novella here. I can either just let it gather dust, or I can go on ahead. Now that self-publishing is cool, I can go on ahead and self-publish it. So I said, you know, why? What have I got to lose? And the reactions from people have been really very, very rewarding. And I have a feeling that's going to be my next thing, is to come up with the next mashup of steampunk and fairy tales.
Awesome.
I have the idea in my head. It's just a matter of sitting down and doing it. But then you've got other mashups. You've got science fiction and horror. You know, I've written another novella, and it's horror, but it's also in an odd way, it's science fiction, because it's actually based on science fact. It just hasn't happened yet.
Okay.
And I'm real proud of that title as well. So, I mean, to me, and what it really comes back to is, you know, I'm going to tell the story. And if the story happens to be a Western with a science fiction feel, or if it's going to be, you know, pirates and ninja assassins and warrior queens, it's going to be that.
That works. That works.
The story is what dictates the genre for me, and where I'm gonna apply it.
So is the lesson here then fan first, and write what you want to write, and then later on you can figure out what to do with it.
Exactly. I mean if you say it's a bit like saying, you know, you know we're gonna go on ahead and we're going to make a viral, and this harkens back to my day job. Whenever people approach clients of mine or now approach my bosses, and they say, yeah, we're a service that specializes in viral videos. We're going to make you a viral video. That is the recipe for disaster in social media. You do not make viral videos. They're called viral videos because they happen virally. And it's the same thing. If you sit down and say, I'm going to write a science fiction novel, it's going to come across like the most pretentious, trite science fiction you'll ever read. What matters first is, what's the story you want to tell? Mm-hmm. Once you get into the story, once you start telling the story, when you're done, then you look back on it and go, huh. So I've written a story about a guy who does XYZ, but he happens to be doing it with someone from another dimension. And now he's finding this rift between dimensions. And if he goes into the other dimension, he's this person. When he's in this dimension, he's this person. So then it becomes speculative fiction. Or he finds out that his protagonist is doing XYZ. He just happens to be doing it in Victorian London with gadgets galore. Then it's steampunk. Let the story happen organically. Let the story happen first. Then you can go back and either leave it alone or decide you want to make it a specific genre. Well, but the story itself has to come first.
But there's writers out there, and you know, hundreds, thousands of them, aspiring and otherwise, that no, I guess you're right. I mean, they sit down, they say they want to write I want to write a fantasy novel, but actually what they're saying is, I have this story and it's a fantasy story, and so their natural creative impulse is to gravitate towards that environment, those components, those elements. Okay. All right. That works.
But then once you have that story, you know what story you want to tell. I mean, with Moravian, with Bilbo Baddings, and this series, this ultimately complex series, how do you keep from losing what the real story is when you're weaving so many different things into it?
Well, that goes back to just committing to the storytelling. I've read a lot of steampunk. I've read a lot of steampunk where the steampunk really is, it harkens back to that song that went viral called Just Glue Gears on It and Call It Steampunk.
Yeah.
There are a lot of steampunk stories out there where the steampunk really is secondary to the story itself. And that annoys the hell out of me. Because part of what makes steampunk steampunk isn't just having the gadgets. It's taking it to the next level. What would gadgets like this do to the society on a whole? How would they how would people apply this? Sure, some of our stuff is set dressing, but some of it also has to be the characters interacting with said steampunk gear.
So are you doing world building before you write your story, or vice versa?
No, I really feel like I have an idea of what the world is, and then I just go on ahead and organically build the world around it. It's a bit like with, you can edit that or leave it in there. I'm a classy dude.
No, that's cool. As long as you're scratching your balls while you're doing it, it's all good.
Yeah, well, it was my ass. Since I just finished reading this particular book, we're in the fourth book. We just finished the fourth book of the Harry Potter series. And part of what makes Harry Potter so brilliant is that J.K. Rowling built the world, and you didn't get passages upon maybe later in the books you did, but instead of passage on passage on passage of world building, you experience the world with Harry. And I think that's part of the actors and the writers' craft is, instead of telling people, well, as you know, Bob, which drives me bananas in stories. Yes, there are times where you're going to have to tell. But if you're having to tell me about the world and the history behind it, you're doing it wrong.
Yeah.
But instead, if you can make it happen organically, if you can have it happen by showing me, if I can experience with the characters what part of this world is going on, then, you know, that to me is a far more rewarding writing experience.
Sure. Don't tell me that the priests of Mythor are oppressive and misogynist. You know, have the lead character be a woman and have her experience that. And then it's much more visceral.
That's much more visceral. And on top of that, I mean, when you say, so how do you stay true to both? You have to, you really do. You really have to commit to both worlds. And with Billy, I had to not only commit to the fact that Billy was in 1929 Chicago, I had to commit to the fact that Billy was a dwarf in 1929 Chicago. So he is going to deal with a lot of snarkiness. He is going to deal with a lot of hatred.
But only once.
But only once. Yeah, but only once. You know, people making wisecracks about his size, you know, stuff like that. But the point was is, okay, if he's going to do this, then, you know, he's going to, that I got to go all the way with this. Mm-hmm. And so, that's part of it. You know, he's either got to deal with, you know, is that if I'm going to write this, I'm not just going to slap on the fantasy and then focus on the mystery, or focus really heavily on the fantasy and the magic and all that and deal with them and just use the mystery as a backdrop. It's got to go both ways. And sometimes when you do mashups, it's effortless. And sometimes when you do mashups, it's painful. But I mean, it's no different. It is no different than Mr. Whedon's writing. I mean, Joss Whedon, when he wrote, I'm sorry, but we constantly go back to it as fans, but Firefly still remains, in my opinion, his best work.
Oh, yeah.
Because he did the space western, but the way he unfolded that world, and the way he unfolded that story and those characters, I mean, it was seamless because he committed to both. He committed to both the western aspect of it, and he also committed to the sci-fi aspect of it. One of my favorite Firefly moments, and this is a real sweet gem of writing, is when there's a bar fight in one of the episodes. I can't remember which episode. It might have been the train job. But they get thrown through a window, which is a classic Western trope. But the window, it turns out, is some type
hologram.
Yeah. And that stuck with me because I'm like, that. And there you go. That's sure. The commitment to both. You get right. The trope of the heroes getting thrown out of the bar, but the window they get thrown out of, it's a hologram.
Well, and you didn't have somebody sitting there telling you, oh, by the way, Bob, that window there is a hologram.
No, right, they got those new hologram windows I see.
So the setting becomes its own character so that you don't have to set it up. It interacts with the characters just as much as they interact with it.
Well, I mean, and that's the other thing, too. When I respect the people that do the Uber world building. I respect what they're doing there. But when the world building becomes a set, mm-hmm. I mean, it just becomes a set, then it's almost like, it's like the difference. It's the difference in going back to the acting, the actor in me. It's something that always drove me bananas as an actor when something went wrong on the set. So you're in the middle of the stage, and something goes wrong with one of the props or something goes wrong in the set. So what happens? The actors ignore it.
Oh right. No.
They pretend there's nothing wrong.
You gotta caveat that though. Bad actors ignore it.
Yes, thank you. I have a story.
So here's my story first.
Okay,
and then,
all right, fine. The guest host can tell his story first. Yeah, fine.
There you go. So we're doing melodrama. We're doing the vampire. We're doing John Polidori's the vampire. Jeez. And my character's supposed to be going a little batty at the end. And during this one scene, one of the characters lost her shawl. It sat for two scenes. It sat in the middle of the stage. Nobody touched it.
Oh, man.
Just nobody could get to it because the segues were too fast. So I get that. I'm out there. Lights come up. I see the veil. I'm like, it's driving me fucking bananas. So,
which is perfect because your character is fucking bananas.
Because my character's starting to lose it a little bit. So behind me, two characters are talking about my delicate condition. So I reached down, grabbed the veil, and it came off of my aunt. And I take a big sniff of it. I hold it close, and I just rock back and forth. I start going, auntie, auntie. People were freaking out. The director was just spooging in her panties because she was like, oh, my God, he solved it. And I'm like, yeah, because I'm an actor. That's what you fucking do.
That's right.
And that's the difference between a world where it's a set and a world where as we as human beings interact with.
Yeah. Yeah.
So there you go.
Nope. That's spot on. That's gold. And that's also unfortunately time.
Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for joining us for our 50 minutes with.
No way. We crossed the 20 minute threshold a while ago, but we're not going that far.
None of it needs to be edited.
No, not a word. It's pure gold. Even the brack, that was awesome too.
That's right.
That's the human aspect of
it. That's right. That's right. We can spin this any which way we want.
Although my shit does smell like potpourri, if you must know.
So really? Really?
Yes.
What is Pip feeding you? I got
flowers.
Know.
Lots and lots of dried flowers.
And berries.
Thank you so much, man. I appreciate you slowing down to 20. And letting us jog alongside the T. Morris machine for a while and sharing some of your insights to the craft. We're much obliged.
My pleasure.
All right. Brian, got anything before we wrap up this episode of 20 Minutes?
No, I gotta go wipe my eyes. I'm crying. I'm having so much fun. So.
Epic. Definitely one of the most distinctive episodes of 20 Minutes we've ever done.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
T, we thank you for that as well.
This has been fun, guys. It's been a lot of fun.
Likewise. All right, friends. Thank you especially for tuning in and joining us, whether you're catching this on Friday when it drops or 5 years from now as it hovers out there in the interwebs. Thank you for tuning in and listening. Tune in on Tuesday. We'll have T's workshop episode where he's going to workshop a story by the host and producer of the Way of the Buffalo podcast, Hugh O'Donnell. So please come back for that. You know it's going to be a riot. Until then, you know, ideas are cheap. Guys, write a story. Brian?
Go right.
Go right, not dole right. That's a whole different thing. Thanks, guys. We'll talk to you later. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
This episode is copyrighted 2012 by the Roundtable Podcast and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share Alike license. That means don't sell it, but you can share it all you like. And you can even use pieces of it in your own derivative work, as long as you attribute us as the source and release the work under the same licensing terms. Theme music composed and performed by the talented Hepcats of Brotown, Gary Gold, David LaBruyere, Billy Nobel, and Matt O'Donnell. If you'd like to be a guest writer or guest host, or learn more about the Roundtable Podcast, please visit our website at www.roundtablepodcast.com. Or visit our Facebook page at facebook.com/roundtablepodcast. Our Twitter tag is @writerspodcast. Or just send us an email at thetable@roundtablepodcast.com. Thanks for listening.